Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Before I tell you about the ice cream, I got to tell you about the crab cakes. You can deliver or ship or gift just in time for Santa, those delicious Fadley's crab cakes that we are missing out here. We've had so many great conversations there and over at State Fair. We will be having them at El Guapo as well over in Catonsville. Curbside, delivery, send them the crab cakes, the shrimp and grits, and the chicken and waffles and all the cool stuff. Take care of all of our local sponsors. And I want to say that before I bring in the Taharka Box of Love made here in Baltimore. $15.70 off the 8-pack here. Fill it up with any of these flavors here, the honey graham, the key lime pie, the delicious, incredible holiday flavors, the sweet potato crumble, the peppermint bark, the eggnog, they're all there. One click, save $15.70 using the code BALTIMOREPOSITIVE. And if you are thinking about buying, selling, listing a home, just need some good advice, Moeller & Gary Realty there for you. Jeff Moeller is going to be joining us before the holidays talking about how COVID has affected the real estate market, how COVID has affected the world, and we're all home. Don, we have so many issues, whether it's Trump or the election or, you know, whether we're talking about tax issues and all this stuff. We haven't done anything on policing here in quite a while, and I know back in the summer we covered all angles in many ways with authors and with people with solutions and people that ran departments. This is close to home, and I saw this on the booking this week. You, as the executive producer here at Baltimore Positive, I'm like, I bet you know Dave Rose. So give me a little story here and bring me up to speed on where you are, former county executive.
Well, I've known Dave for many years, president of the Baltimore County FOP Lodge 4. And you're right, Nestor. I can't think of any more important topic. And when I called Dave to talk about coming on the show, I said to him, I think it's by far the most complex topic that we've talked about. And that's and I realize that in our coverage, and you're right, we've talked to academicians, we've talked to current police chiefs, former police chiefs, we've talked to journalists who cover the police beat. I realize we had talked about elected officials passing legislation and executive orders regarding police reform and public safety. But we had a missing voice, and it's the key voice, and it's a voice that has to be heard, and that is the voice of the men and women of the police department themselves. And you know, full disclosure, I have, you know, a cousin who unfortunately passed away to cancer, but was like a brother to me. Was a major, came up in the state police. Our careers paralleled each other. I was in education, he was in public safety. He ended up as a major in the state police. I have another cousin who's a correctional officer, had another cousin who was a Baltimore City police officer for decades. So I have a soft spot in my heart for those who go out and risk their lives each and every day. It's personal to me. Every time I heard an officer was in danger, it was personal. And Dave, it's personal to you and the men and women that you represent. I just want to cut to the chase and have you really start by telling our listeners, what's it like to be a police officer in 2020? Because it seems really hard to Nestor and me.
Don, thanks for having me on. It is. I've been an officer since 1987, so 33 years. And by far, this is the most unusual year in policing that we've ever experienced, and I've been here through Rodney King and 9/11 and all those. It's unique because it started back in March when the COVID started happening, and you know, there were shortages of PPE gear and nobody really knew how to handle certain instances, and it was kind of a figure it out as you go along, and you know, you make some mistakes, you fix it, you move on. But we're getting, you know, coming up on the end of 9 months into it right now, and you can tell the fatigue factor setting in, you know, when you put it in combination with, you know, COVID and all the extra precautions you have to take, and you know, it just wears on somebody after time. So it's difficult, but our guys are out there managing. They're showing up every day. They're working hard, and they're getting the job done the way they're supposed to, but it has been taxing.
How has COVID been? I mean, we saw the football team get ravaged, literally, right? And we've talked about doctors and nurses over the course of time. How is Baltimore County and COVID? I mean, when I think of police officers, I mean, that's essential. I mean, that's out in front, and that's dealing with people and getting up on people and having to communicate with people, not on Zoom. You know, can't be a cop and do it on Zoom, right? So I would think that on the curve, riskier, not just riskier for all the reasons that are obvious for police officers, but COVID. Well, where are you 9 months in with your officers?
I think we're well into the triple digits of officers who have tested positive. I don't get the exact, you know, names of the officers who have tested positive because of HIPAA reasons, for obviously. It's medical information. But we've probably had between 200 and 300 officers quarantined for suspected exposures, and I know we've had over 100 officers that have at least tested positive.
How many are there, just as a percentage? How many officers in Baltimore County?
We have an authorized strength of 1907 or 1914, somewhere around there, but we have about 1,800 on 1,825.
Well, that's 15% right of the people that have at least been quarantined. That's a significant number, right?
Oh, yeah, it is. And then you're talking about the effects of, you know, going home, and now you have your wife and kids or your husband and kids, you know, and now not only are they quarantined with you because of what you brought home. So it has an effect that goes further beyond the officer. It affects the whole family.
RG3 mentioned that in the aftermath of the Steelers game. Go ahead, Don.
Now, you know, all of this, you factor in COVID and the climate and all of the issues surrounding police reform, and Dave, folks that listen to the show, and I'm going to throw out my premise to you and feel free to shoot holes in it, because frequent listeners to the show will have heard me say this before. I actually, this goes back now several years, but in a speech I wrote for county executive candidates, I put in, I'm going to paraphrase, but I put in something very similar to what I'm about to say. And it was that at this time in our history, parents of young African American men and women are more nervous than they've ever been in their life when their teenagers go out for the evening and they worry specifically about them having a difficult interaction with a police officer. I believe that to be true. I also believe this next point to be true, that the spouses and loved ones and moms and dads and aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters of police officers are more worried about the safety of their loved one who's a police officer who goes to work each and every day to protect us than they've ever been in history. So I think both of those things are true. And from where I sit, the fact that both of those things are true are a recipe for bad things happening. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, I don't disagree. And you know, I know there's this realization, perception out there that, you know, minorities have, I guess, a distrust of the policing, and it stems back way further than currently. It's just kind of come to a head recently, you know, in the last couple of years because of, you know, some unfortunate events that happened across the country have gotten the attention. But it also works the same way on the family side of police officers, because you've actually seen more police officers ambushed over the last couple of years. Shootings of police officers are up. Shootings at police officers are up. Assaults on police officers around the country is up. Fortunately, here in Baltimore County, they've trended down over the last 10 years, which is nice. But we enjoy a relationship with the community in Baltimore County that a lot of places don't enjoy. We have a general trust, not a total trust with every segment of the population, but we have a good relationship with the Baltimore County citizens at large. always work to do in certain areas. It can always be done better. And I think that starts with conversation, exchange of information, because a lot of the mistrust comes from the lack of understanding on both sides. So it's the police understanding of some different cultures and things, way things happen. And it's also the lack of understanding as to why police do certain things the way they do it, and, you know, why those procedures are taught and what, you know, how we conduct ourselves. So I think a lot of those things could be resolved with more conversation between groups. And that would start with a more in-depth community policing policy. We had, when I came on in 1987, we had a really in-depth community policing philosophy. Over the years in my career, it drifted more from everyone being involved in the community policing to more of an enforcement type style. And you had units that did community policing. So it kind of separated along the line somewhere. And we started drifting away from the positive contacts in the community. And then when you get to 2008 or 2009, when we had the crash, the economic crash, you know, one of the first things that took the hit was the elimination of officers in the PAL centers. Well, that was an excellent point of contact by our officers with, you know, youths in the community, and mostly in your poor neighborhoods and your minority neighborhoods. And there was a great opportunity to have those positive contacts. That disappeared. And now 10 years later, we're seeing some of the effects of that that weren't, you know, were unforeseen at that point. And it's like we lost a chance to have positive relationships with an entire generation. And now we have to figure out how to catch up and get back in the process of doing that.
Dave, I want to follow up on that. A couple of things you said. One, I want you to explain to folks from your point of view what community policing should and would look like. And I also want you to talk a little bit about what you hear, because you alluded to it, what you hear from rank and file officers about their interactions with the public in Baltimore County. Because certainly my predecessors and I, we would always say, and it was one of the reasons why we resisted so much this effort to become sort of part of ICE and have the police officers viewed as immigration officers, because we would say, look, our police officers rely on the trust of the people that they're protecting to solve crimes. And if they become afraid of the cops, they're going underground, and it's going to make the cops less safe. It's going to make people less safe. So all of that seems to come true. But talk to us about what you think community policing looks like, and then what you're hearing from the men and women on the beat.
The community policing philosophy in the police department cannot be done by just a couple different specialized units. Right now we have our community outreach unit. Those officers do a fantastic job. We have our school resource officers. Those guys, you know, guys, men and women do a fantastic job.
What does that
job
mean, by the way, community outreach? Define that for me. Because, you know, I go back to like Obama earlier in the week talking about the defund the police and all, and what that means. But it might mean a different kind of thing than a guy with a gun or a gal with a gun, a traditional officer as we know it, that shows up for a multitude of different things that, quite frankly, as an officer, you show up, you know, there were times where you're like, you don't need me, you need a specialist in some other way, right? And I think we would call the police to come get a cat out of a tree, literally, right?
Back in 2005, I think it was, I was actually a sergeant in the community outreach unit. So I was in charge of a unit over in White Marsh Precinct. Those officers, there's probably half a dozen in there. They are assigned certain neighborhood associations and certain neighborhood groups to go interact with the community relations council, the different neighborhood associations.
It's a public relations arm.
Yes.
Community relations, but yes.
But you also handle problems that are in the community specifically assigned to you that weren't your traditional policing issues. So you did a lot of mediation, conversations. You took a non-enforcement way of handling certain things.
When you say certain things, I mean, two neighbors having a dispute,
it could be neighbors having a dispute that doesn't need to go through the police department. It could be a juvenile issue, kids hanging out at a park after dark, maybe a drinking complaint somewhere on a dirt road. you know, and you, instead of using your enforcement end of the police department to go down there, you might use your community outreach unit officers to go, you know, hand out alcohol education letters, go down there. Maybe if they found people drinking, not take an enforcement mode, but kind of, you know, take you home to your parents and say, look, these are discussions we got to have. Just non-traditional style. And it's actually not like we're doing today. It was almost a little bit like the old school foot post kind of guy. Let me take you home and, you know, let your parents deal with this, or let me do it in a non-enforcement way by, you know, maybe you end up, you know, washing cars or picking up trash in a neighborhood one day for your punishment, to say, you know. So those kind of things. And they were problem solvers and points of contact for the neighborhood association. So that was basically that community's officer, you know, and that officer may be assigned half a dozen to a dozen different communities, depending on what neighborhood you're in or what precinct you're in. And that was their contact officer, their point of reference for contact in the precinct. And it worked really well. And we have to kind of expand that to the point where it's not just a unit that does that, but all the post car officers end up doing that. So when you're assigned a post car, and maybe your post car is, you know, Perry Hall, an area in Perry Hall, well, then you have to take some sort of ownership of that post. And maybe you are the officer going to those community meetings in the evening, or you're the point of contact, and you take some sort of ownership, and you know the president of Community Association A and the president of Community Association B. But that comes with a cost, which is always the problem, Don, as we know, because some of those things don't always happen in the traditional 8 hours that we work. Unfortunately, I had, when I was a post car officer in Essex back in the 90s, I had, you know, then Major Kim Ward, now Colonel Kim Ward, who's deceased, you know, rest her soul, but I had a neighborhood that needed a lot of attention, and she actually authorized me to, if something happened in that neighborhood outside of my normal 8 hour tour of duty, to come in and handle it and be visible, you know, go to their community association fair. I actually took my kids to the fair, so people got to see me as, you know, Dave Rose instead of
Citizen Rose, right?
Yes. Yeah. So they got to see me in a different role, and I had my kids there, and it made me more approachable by a lot of civilians in the community. The Citizens on Patrol took a bike training class, and I took the bike training class with them. So those type of things, you know, have to start happening on a wider scale. But with that comes the time commitment and the financial commitment to do it. And if organizations are going to truly get into the traditional community policing style, they're going to have to realize there is going to be a cost to give people the type of policing that they want.
Don, you're on mute. Go ahead.
No, that's really helpful, Dave. And then the second part of that question was, what do you hear from the men and women in the department now about their interactions during this really contentious time? Are your officers, I'm trying to think of how to phrase it, are they still optimistic about their future as police officers? Because I read so much about police morale across the nation. How are your men and women feeling?
That's a two-part question. And I will tell you, I've been out and about talking to officers around the county, and they are being thanked and being told they're appreciated by a huge number of members of citizens of Baltimore County. Our people are constantly being told, hey, thank you. I appreciate what you do. I've spoken to officers that have said, you know, I've had people buy my lunch 3 times this week and never even tell me. You know, every time they go to pay for it, it's paid for. So by and large, the citizens of Baltimore County love their police department. We still have work to do. It's a never ending job. The police and community relations is not a goal. It's something that has to be ongoing and never stop, because you're always working towards keeping it going and making it better. And so that type of interaction with the public is going really well. Our officers did a great job during all the protests in Baltimore County. I don't think we had one arrest in any of the protests at all. And, you know, those can be kind of contentious at times. And, but there is an uncertainty about the future. Officers are kind of on the edge, like, where is policing going to be? I was talking with an officer this morning, and you know, we were talking about something else and got on the subject. And he says, I don't even know what we're doing next week, much less next month. I don't know where this department's going. I don't know where the county's going. I don't know where policing is going. And that uncertainty doesn't sit well out there with your rank and file. I mean, we have 65 people retiring in on January 1st or 2nd. And a lot of that is time in service and time on the job. You know, Don, there are certain pay periods in the year when you want to go, you know that, and this is one of them. But it is rather large. We haven't had a retirement like this since 1992, when we had the, you know, recession back in the 90s. And that uncertainty makes people make decisions to leave earlier. And that uncertainty has also hurt us in recruitment. Right now, it is very, very difficult to recruit enough qualified people to get into the academy to be police officers, because everything they see on the news, everything they see on social media, they're just like, maybe that job is not something I want to do right now. I'll go do something else. I
mean, well, this is where Don always tells his famous story. Don, tell him what you talked about with adventure and your quote about that, because I think for every young person, I was never someone that...
Yeah, it's my favorite quote.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and Don brings it up all the time, and every time I see an officer, I think about that quote. Yeah.
I had Dave will probably know who said this because he didn't just say it to me, but I had a former police commissioner, and Dave, you and I, you know, we've talked about recruitment a lot, and I spent a lot of time and energy on recruitment, trying to make sure that the men and women that we were recruiting reflected Baltimore County and had a real diversity about it, and that the police department looked like the community they represented. And I asked a former police chief one time, tell me what's the key to recruiting. And I've never forgotten it. The police chief said to me, Don, if we had a way to be sure that we were hiring officers who were interested in being police officers out of service, as opposed to those who wanted to become police officers in search of adventure, my job would be 100 times easier. That when you find the officers, who I think we've done a pretty good job in Baltimore County, of finding those officers who want to be there because of service, as opposed to adventure, that's half the key to recruiting, more than half the key.
Oh, I don't disagree. You know, my father was a police officer before me in the same police department. And, you know, so I'm sitting here, and we have a lot of legacy officers in this police department. So we do have that.
You got one run in the county, right? Literally.
Well, yeah, his brother's on the job. And
right.
So I've, you know, dealt with them for the last two decades, you know, speaking with them, and I know them personally outside of their positions that they're in right now. So, but
small, it's more.
Yeah, it's true. It's small. I mean, we have to figure out how to get people that want to serve to come on the job. And I made this statement to somebody a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about it, and we were talking about, you know, what you said, Don, the reflecting the community that you serve. And over the last decade, I did some research before we started to have that conversation. And while we're still not there, because it's very difficult because of people coming and people leaving, but our diversity has increased about 60% over the last 10 years, and still work to do, no doubt about it. But, you know, the distrusting part of the community and largely in the minority part of the community. And my thoughts have been this: look, if you have a distrust in policing, or you don't like the way policing is being conducted, we need good people. If you're a good person, please apply, come, be part of us. Be on the inside with us. See what goes on. If you don't like something, fix it from the inside. Be part of the change. Instead of standing outside yelling for change, come join us, be part of the change. And hopefully some people will take that advice.
I'm hoping some folks out there who hear this, because you're right, we need good people. We need good people. Dave, I want to, and we are with Dave Rose, president of FOP Lodge 4, Baltimore County. I want to give you what I think is the toughest criticism leveled at the FOP. Nestor's heard it raised on the program. I have to think this one through because I think it's a challenge, and that is that the FOPs across the country will say that they don't support rogue cops, bad cops. It's a gun trace task force type stuff, which besmirched everybody. Nestor knows nothing made me angrier than the gun trace task force, because I think it was a discredit to all the wonderful.
I just read that book this weekend or last weekend. It was horrible. My jaw dropped. It was crazy. Yeah.
Well, we had them on.
Our jaws were dropping. Go watch that episode with Brandon Soderberg and Boehner Wood. I mean, it's unbelievable.
We were speechless, and we'll talk a little bit about it. I'm not going to ask you to weigh in on that because you weren't in Baltimore City. But here's the issue that I want you to respond to, and I know you'll be honest about it, is that people say FOP will say they don't want bad cops, but man, they make it awfully hard to get rid of bad cops. And that when a bad cop shows up to be bad, the FOP rallies around them. Shoot holes in that theory for me.
Okay. Actually, yes. So nobody likes a bad cop. I used to have two sets of handcuffs, and it was well known, and I would say it. If anybody's doing something wrong around me, if you're going to be corrupt, do not do it around me, because I got two sets of cuffs, one for the bad guy and one for you. I'll lock you up in uniform. I don't care. So there's, 800,000 cops in this country. Not everybody is going to be good. But the complaints that come into Baltimore County over years, we actually have more complaints that go to internal affairs that are officer on officer than we do citizens on officers. So the police department, at least here in Baltimore County, that thin blue wall of silence that people see on TV and hear about, really is not in existence here, because our officers will make complaints. They got a duty to do it. I mean, it's part of the rules and regulations. That's what you're supposed to do. And we actually have more complaints and a higher sustained rate. So we actually have 7 times more complaints that are sustained officer to officer than we do citizen to officer. So that's one side. So officers are, if they see something, saying something.
So I want to clarify that, Dave, and I apologize for interrupting, but I'm hearing you as the president of FOP saying, look, I told folks around me, if you're going to be a rogue cop, I'm arresting you. And as the president of the FOP, you're saying to those folks out there listening right now, we don't want dishonest rogue cops in the Baltimore County Police Department.
Don, there are people that have known me for a long time, and many of them voted for me to elect me as president of this organization. I don't like bad cops, and I can't stand lazy cops. Either way, I don't put up with either one of them. And that's just a fact. And if you're going to be a bad cop, don't come here. And if you're going to come here and you're going to try to do something wrong, you're going to get caught. And my advice to you is going to be, I think you should resign. I've talked many people into resigning without even going to a hearing board. Over the last 10 years, we've only had 10 hearing boards. So they don't happen that often, because if someone calls me after they had a sustained complaint at internal affairs, we look at it. I have no problem looking at somebody in the eye and saying, you know what? You might have an argument. Go to a hearing board. Or I'll look them straight in the eye and go, you have no argument. You should resign. You know, they always have that final decision on their own, but I don't have an issue with telling somebody, right to their face, looking at the case. But it's very rare. I mean, we don't have that many of those type cases. I mean, we've had 50 trial boards in the last 20 years, and we average about 2.5 a year. We went 4 years with none. So 71% or 76% of those officers are found guilty, and I think 71% of those termination recommendations officers are found guilty.
Well, I think so, as a citizen, you just want to know where the line is between where the union says maybe you're not cut out to do this anymore, or maybe you once were good at it, like a quarterback. I would think your ability to police would get better as you get older, but also maybe your tolerance would be, you know, that at some point you would say, I don't want to do this anymore, and someone would find another way to do this, right? It's not a job for life in that way, that it's going to be the same job now that it is 20 years, because the job evolves and changes all the time, right?
That's what's fun about this job. I've been here 33 years, and every few years it changes. It changes every time a new case law either happens in the Supreme Court or the Maryland Court of Appeals, and it is great that way. But the line you're talking about there is very difficult to navigate, and over the last 20 years as vice president and president, I've learned to navigate it. As the union representative, we have by law a duty to represent somebody. So our duty to represent is getting you competent counsel. And that competent counsel can do whatever they need to do to give you a fair defense and through a due process. But, you know, that doesn't mean I can't look at somebody in the eye personally and say, we're not funding that. And we've made those decisions before in this organization where we've said, we're not funding that. And I think that's kind of what sets us apart from a lot of different organizations, because we can make those hard decisions. We've done it in the last couple of years. We said, we're not funding that. And we get to, what, you're my representative. Like, yeah, if you are successful and you win, you can come back to us and have that conversation, but we're not funding it. So it's not necessarily defending bad cops, but there's also, you got to be careful that there's that legal duty to represent also. So that's part of what the public doesn't really understand. And it's not any different in our union than it is in any other different labor organization throughout the country. If you're a member, your labor organization has a duty to represent you, whether in an interview with your boss or a disciplinary process or a ratings appeal process. So there is an obligation that you're legally bound by.
Well, I understood. But the morning after George Floyd happens and you see all 9 minutes of that as someone who does what you do, I mean, I'm a citizen. I'm appalled. My wife's into, you know, like all of that, right? But different for you, right? Because that happens in Timonium, God forbid, right? Or wherever. I mean, respond to how that made you feel watching that the first day, because that was, it set the country sideways.
It was interesting to watch, and I've never had a chance to watch the whole 9 minutes. I've only seen clips, but it brings a lot of questions, you know, internally as to what, why, what was the reason, what was the training, you know, what was the circumstances, what happened before, what happened after, not offering any excuses for the behavior or the actions.
Well, the citizen for me would say, what's the consequences for that? You know,
we're gonna find that out, because they've been charged criminally and the criminal process will play itself out. And, you know, I don't know the answer to whether their union is representing them in the criminal defense or whether they're not. And, you know, they have to make that decision internally as to whether they do that or not.
Dave, picking up on, you know, it was George Floyd, Jacob Blake, we go down the list, Breonna Taylor. There's a whole series of unfortunate, really unfortunate and horrific incidences that led to discussions of police reform all across the country. And what was interesting to me was that Baltimore County moved forward rather quickly at police reform, executive orders and legislation. And by everything that I read, and by all accounts and folks that I've talked to, the FOP was at the table in Baltimore County saying, let's work on this legislation, let's get it right. So rather than resist the calls for police reform, it's my understanding that you were very much front and center in helping to craft the legislation. I want you to tell me if my recollection is correct, and then tell us what the legislation did and why you thought it was a move in the right direction.
No, Don, you're exactly right. So what happened is Councilman Julian Jones put in his original bill, and he sent it to our office, you know, to look at. You know, and I really appreciate that. And there were two different conversations Julian Jones and I had, and they were about 4 hours, maybe a little longer than 4 hours, about, you know, the feasibility of what could work, what couldn't work, why something would not work. And I told him, I said, it's very difficult to craft legislation, which was actually crafting policy, and some things were being made a crime. I said, but you can write the legislation or the policy any way you want. If it is, it is ineffective if the people cannot understand it appropriately and implement it efficiently and properly. So that bill went through the process, and of course it got tabled. As soon as the bill got, the original bill got tabled, I approached the administration and said, look, this, there's a big demand for this to get done. I think we can all sit in a room and craft something that will work. And Don, not patting Baltimore County on the back, you know, too much, but most of that we're already doing here in Baltimore County. So we're ahead of the curve. Some agencies aren't, but we are. So a lot of that we're already doing, but the citizens wanted to see it. They wanted to be able to tangibly hold it, read it, and know that there was something that it was, they would be able to read and look and see that is policy. So we crafted it. We worked together on it. The administration and I communicated back and forth quite a lot, several council people. But yes, I was proud that we could sit in a room and work together on a project, because I think something like that has to have the involvement of all the stakeholders at the table for it to be effective.
Well, it really was. And again, I knew some community folks who were out there advocating and very, very outspoken on it. And again, I think you're right. I mean, without, you know, you and I are Baltimore County guys, but without, you know, going too overboard. I mean, we had a county executive in John Oshesky Jr. You had a council leader in Julian Jones. You had yourself, Dave Rose, as the FOP. You had community advocates. Actually, I mean, Nestor's been, this is the kind of thing Nestor's been talking about now for several years. You actually got in a room, you rolled up your sleeves, and you said, let's see if we can't make this better.
Not perfect. And not perfect.
We made better. It better.
I can do you one better, Don. 60 days ago, I approached the administration again, and I said, look, there's been a cry for also putting voting citizens on hearing boards in police departments. Let's get together and work on getting that done here in Baltimore County. And I will tell you, we are almost to that point where it's complete. We're in contract negotiations right now, and I believe at the end of the day, it will be part of a total package that will go out for ratification.
Well, I do want to single you out, Dave, and applaud you for that, because I think that's really, really important, and I congratulate you for that. I don't want to end with the Gun Trace Task Force, because again, it wasn't Baltimore County, but I will tell you that it's the question that Nestor and I have asked of the professors that have been on, of the police chiefs. I think the part you read the book. I think the part about something like the Gun Trace Task Force that makes people raise an eyebrow, and maybe you can help us understand this culture, is how the heck that could happen without everybody knowing it was happening. The other guys on the beat, the chiefs, the captains, that when the public says to me, they'll go, Don, how could something like that have been going on and not everybody know about it? From a police perspective, can you shed some light on that?
From my understanding in reading the book and talking to some people, it looked like this was a unit that had complete autonomy and very little supervision, except for the sergeant, who was the main conspirator in the whole thing. He apparently had gotten to a spot where he had, I guess, been given wide breadths of, you know, availability to do things.
Work, that's the only way it could happen, right? Literally, right?
Yeah. And then it seemed to me from reading the book that I don't think management, in my opinion, was unaware of it. I think a lot of people turned their heads because they were putting up good numbers of gun seizures and drug seizures and money seizures. And this gets put on a table and pictures get taken and we got guns and we got money. But where's the convictions? If according to the book, and I preface with according to the book, you know, there are public defenders that can't believe that Marilyn Mosby's office didn't know about it, you know, because there were hearings in court on officer credibility that just seemed to be ignored. So it just seemed like a failure in management to keep some sort of supervision. You give a unit like this that much responsibility and that much autonomy, you have to have strong supervision over top of it. Because if not, you're looking for something bad to happen. And it did. And hopefully nothing like that ever happens again. Because I just read some of the things in that book that happened. And Don, I was like, oh my God, I can't even imagine that happening here, you know, in Baltimore County. I would be just flabbergasted and embarrassed if it happened.
Yeah. I kept saying that to Nestor over and over. It was, you know, we talked to Jane Miller. That sergeant, was it Wayne Jenkins, I guess was his name. Yeah. I think that was his name. I mean, that guy was Tony Soprano. I mean, he was the head of a criminal enterprise. But this is Baltimore positive. Let's end on something more positive. So talk first of all, in the olden days, we'd be at holiday parties or family get-togethers. Will happen again. You're at a cookout this summer, maybe after the vaccine, and we can get together again. And somebody says, hey, my son or daughter over here is thinking about being a police officer. Nestor likes to call them your elevator speech. What's your elevator speech to a young man or woman as to why they should come into your profession and make a difference?
It's very hard to have one right now, Nestor, because I actually had a nephew that wanted to come on this job, and I was kind of like, maybe it's not the right time for that. But if somebody wanted to come on this job and they needed a pep speech, my speech would be this. You don't come on this job to do the job of a police officer. You come on this job because you want to be a police officer. You don't want to do the job of a police officer. Police officer is not a job. It's a way of life. I grew up in a household of law enforcement. My daughters, who are both, you know, are biracial, grew up in a household of law enforcement. And it is a style and way of life for your entire family because of the shift work, because of the hours and the things that you're going to miss and the Christmases and holidays that you're not going to be able to be there for. So this isn't a job you can come into and expect to punch a clock in, punch a clock out. You could come here at 7 o'clock in the morning and expect to get off at 3 and be working 24 hours. Or God forbid, you could come in, punch the clock at 7 and at 9 o'clock you're in a hospital somewhere. So it's a lifestyle. And if you want the lifestyle, then this is the job for you. I can tell you I've had 33 years and 32 of them have been fantastic. That one that wasn't, the year after that made up for it double fold. So you're not going to have a career that is going to be all roses every year. So you're going to have some.
Well, you are, because your last name. But
yeah, well, thank you. But you're gonna have a couple bad times. But overall, I got to tell you, I can look back at my 33 years right now and say this has been a fantastic career. It's been a fun job. I've loved every minute of it, and I'm hoping to enjoy it for a few more years.
Well, Dave, on my behalf, certainly as someone as former county executive, please, you're out and about with the men and women every day. I wished I could have shaken each and every one of their hands. I tell folks all the time, bad apples, like you said, bad teachers, bad doctors, bad attorneys, bad insurance salesmen. Yeah, nobody's 100%, but my experience and the time certainly that I spent with the men and women who protected me during my time as county executive, and all the folks I've gotten to meet around this county, just exemplary service. So on my behalf and on behalf of Baltimore Positive, when you see them, please thank them for me.
Oh, not a problem. I will, and I appreciate the venue to have these discussions, and I think they got to happen more often on a broader range, and I look forward to joining them and getting it done.
See, we grew up in Dundalk. You grew up with people to become Baltimore County cops, like Officer Rommel. So give some love out there to our East Side and our friends as well. So appreciate you, Dave. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Thanks, Nestor.
Yeah, I was going to feature the website as well. I want to let everybody know, at least if you want to find out more. And I'll pull it up here real quick. It's FOP Lodge number 4. I'll grab it just so everybody can see it here at the end as I talk about our friends at DeHarka. They have a whole welcome here and all the news. And everybody knows somebody related to and loves a cop in Baltimore County. So we'll give a shout-out out there. You can find former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller now, along with all of our work and Luke Jones and all of our Raven stuff and all of our traditional WNST sports content at one place. It's all at Baltimore Positive, like the hat, like the shirt says. And at Baltimore Positive, we are doing ice cream better than anybody's ever done it because it's the best ice cream in the world because it's made here in Baltimore with love, local love. Make sure you're ordering. Let's see here. If I could put an 8-pack of dreams together, honey graham, pistachio, sweet potato crumble, eggnog, peppermint bark. Make sure you're not sleeping on a chocolate love. Probably a little caramel crunch and roasted strawberry for the tart member of your family. You order them just like that. 27 flavors available. You click on it, put Baltimore Positive in. You will get $15.70 off when the box of love comes to you. We talked to Rafael Alvarez. We talked to Jamie Costello. We're keeping it all local and all Baltimore Positive. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, and Baltimore Positive.